The world today is all about being mobile, being safe, being healthy, and I think cycling fits those values. People don't lose their jobs in this team if they don't win. It has a deeper meaning and a bigger purpose behind it. When we distribute the bicycles in these communities with our pro riders and they tell them that they earn a living off this bicycle, it opens their eyes up to a sport that they for the most part didn't really know existed.
I'm Declan Burke and welcome to a special edition of The Sit Down, the podcast that explores the mindset, motivations and opinions of the elite talent, brands and rights holders represented by Sport Endorse. Today's guest, a driving force in the professional cycling world, is Doug Ryder, principal of UCI World Tour team, Team Quebeca Assos. Doug fell in love with cycling age 12, captained the South African cycling team, competed in the 96 Summer Olympics in Atlanta, was a professional cyclist, and founded what is now Africa's only World Tour team. You'll hear about the origins of the team, its purpose, how important that is, ensuring that doping in cycling remains an issue in the past, and how sports sponsorship has been changing pre and post the current global pandemic. There are some compelling case studies in how Doug and the team have delivered. Enjoy. Hello, Doug.
Yeah, hello, Declan.
So, listen, to get started, I thought it would be interesting if everybody listening could get to know a tiny bit about you, Doug. So, first question is, where do you come from?
So, I come from Cape Town in sunny South Africa. So, born in 1971. And it was obviously a beautiful place for cycling and a beautiful place to grow up.
There you've touched on cycling. So a question I have actually is, what attracted you to cycling in the first place? Was it the nice weather or a desire to just get on a bike and move? What was it?
Well, you know, in Cape Town, we had this big grand fondo or fun ride, as we call it, the Cape Town Cycle Tour. Then it was the Argus Cycle Tour and it went and rode around the peninsula. And it was really a beautiful event. But there was the one big thing that got me into cycling was when a British team came to race a race in South Africa. And it was the Report Tour at the time. So it was the national tour of South Africa. And my uncle was very interested in cycling and he took me along and got me interested in the sport. And I really enjoyed it. And I actually got an Allen bike bought from one of the British riders before he went back home, and I bought his bike, or my uncle bought his bike, and that was kind of got me hooked, I guess. But I've always was interested in cycling, as you know, from when I was a little boy. My parents didn't buy me a bike; they said I was too young, and I only got my first bike when I was 12 years old, and then I literally used to ride all the time. So I love the freedom and the independence that cycling gave you.
Okay, that's pretty cool. Which leads to, I know you were captain of the South African cycling team and competed in the 96 Olympics for the country. So what's that like?
Well, I think competing at the Olympic Games is something incredible. You know, when you with thousands of the best athletes in the world across all different sports, it's a real privilege. And only, you know, a small percentage of the world sporting people, I guess, get to go to an Olympic Games and to represent your country at something of that significance is pretty amazing. So, yeah, it was a highlight, absolutely, that I'll never forget. It was in Atlanta in the US, which was amazing. It was so well organized. It was an amazing experience to be in that Olympic village. And with only 85 to 90 other South Africans, we were quite a small Olympic delegation. I raced the road race, the endurance race. It was the first professional and amateur Olympic Games. So it was against Lance Armstrong and Mario Cipollini and Abdu Japarov and all of the big riders and the names, Miguel Indurain, Alex Zula, all the big names of that time. And so it was a pretty tough event, being the first professional and amateur Olympic Games.
Wow. Yeah, definitely special. So how do you go from that, from competing at that kind of a level, to deciding to set up a professional team?
Well, I raced professionally in Europe from 1992 to about 1997, and it was really tough. It was at a difficult time in cycling, and so I didn't really have a chance as an individual to make it as a professional bike rider. Those days, there was professionals and amateurs. There wasn't the under 23 and the development categories that there are today. So it was either you were pro or you were amateur. You made money or you didn't. You were in a team or you weren't. And so there wasn't kind of any building blocks or anything that was available for you to, you know, kind of develop and walk through the steps to become a top-level rider. So I then came back to South Africa in 1997. And then, you know, post those Olympic Games and started my own cycling team in South Africa with the dream of one day, you know, taking a super good South African, African registered team to the highest level in world cycling.
Okay, well, there you go. You're certainly living your dream, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So, and then, I mean, the team at the moment, and for the last decade plus, has had this kind of very strong link with the Quebeca charity. So can you explain briefly what the Quebeca charity does?
So Quebeca is a not-for-profit organization. It's an Nguni Zulu word that means to move forward, to progress, to carry on. And it's all about bicycles and mobilizing people on bicycles. So it's a bike company, ultimately, and the bicycles are assembled in South Africa by South Africans, you know, for, I guess, South Africa and Africans to be able to be mobile and get access to school and to independence and to be entrepreneurial. And it's a great program and a great project because it's a work to earn model. So the bicycles aren't gifted to the recipients. They are earned either through growing trees, and we call those individuals treepreneurs, so like entrepreneurs, but treepreneurs that grow trees to earn the bikes. And then there's trashpreneurs or wastepreneurs that clean up waste and trash in the community. You know, there's community service, and kids that do community service can get the bicycles. And then, of course, the big project is that we focus on, you know, right now is the education program. Kids that go to school, improve their grades, up their attendance, you know, get to use the bicycles and get to keep those bicycles over time. So it's it really is fantastic what Quebeca does, and the fact that it is ultimately a work to earn model, and so it's an exciting organization to be associated with.
Yeah, it's certainly the bit I've read about it as well. I certainly I'm sold on it. Yeah. So one of the things I've read about is this Quebeca Bike Day. So what's it like being there for a bike day?
You know, a distribution ceremony is one of the most amazing days, and I always refer to them as the best day of the year. And they happen almost every Thursday, where we do a distribution ceremony to either a school or a community or healthcare workers or even now spotters. We give that are out there to try and, you know, test to see if people have got the pandemic in this COVID time. So it's a, you know, it's just really, really, you know, really brilliant what Quebeca is doing and mobilizing people on bicycles.
Okay, great. So I'm going to shift now to just cycling as a sport. As you know, in Sport Endorse, we deal with lots of different sports, and each one thinks they're the best. So I wanted to ask you, what is it that you think sets cycling apart from other sports?
I think cycling is an incredibly tough sport. It's a sport that is played, and its stadium is the open roads of the Pyrenees, the Alps, the flatlands in the Netherlands. It's you know, it's something that is geographically dispersed. It has huge cultural diversity, massive amounts of races and global presence all around the world. It's built and made up of teams of brilliant individuals that come together under one strategy to try and win. And when you win, it's like making magic happen. When you've got the planning and the strategy and the equipment and all of that dialed in, it's something, you know, incredibly special. But it's a sport that is played and ridden in any weather conditions on, you know, pretty much any road surfaces, and you have a 1 in 200 chance of winning with so many riders on the start line, and you've got lots of other things that can happen. So planning and strategy and all these things go into it. And then there's, of course, there's incidents and accidents that happen along the way. And it's just a sport of gladiators, but it's got the most unbelievable passion and emotion. And it's incredible. It's not about money. It's about, you know, what you can get out of each other, and you know, just your preparation and the commitment of every individual to each other, you know, to have a plan to make it succeed and to win is incredible. And there's so many races within the race, which makes it incredibly exciting and sometimes hard to understand. You know, you will have teams that'll go for the overall win. Some will go for an individual classification within the race. So, you know, it's so dynamic, so exciting, and it's pretty riveting watching it and being a part of it in a mobile team that goes and travels 286 days a year in 25 countries on 5 continents. It's an unbelievable moving ship that is the sport of cycling.
Yeah, certainly. My father was a big cycling fan. So when I was a kid, I was privileged enough to be on the side of the road watching the Tour de France zip by. And I always felt that the build up to it was great. But when for the riders to go by was actually relatively short. So it was some of the fun that you had with all the other supporters around was very interesting as well. So in terms of cycling in Africa, I understand through Quebeca how important a bike is to mobilize communities and how that work is being done. Is it present in Africa as a sport yet?
It is. It's getting bigger. The UCI, the governing body of the sport, invested a lot of energy and effort, I guess, into growing the sport of cycling on the African continent and providing and creating events and working with national federations and governments and, you know, across the African continent. Very strong nations in Africa are Eritrea, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Morocco, Egypt, and of course South Africa, or Namibia as well. Very strong cycling nations. So it's a great sport across the African continent. It has its challenges. There's no, you know, really any major events which doesn't bring often the big international field to Africa, but that is changing. It looks like in the next 3 to 4 or 5 years, the World Road Racing Championships will be based in a country and across the African continent, which will be just absolutely incredible to have these a race like that with the best riders in the world coming to the continent of Africa and being a part of, you know, the great culture of people that Africa has, and its amazing diversity and beautiful roads and terrain. So, and it'll, from that point of view, it'll definitely grow and become, you know, a sport more recognized on the continent.
Yeah, it should be spectacular when it gets there, for sure, and on that kind of a level. And now maybe a controversial question. Again, as a sport, previously anyway, cycling has got tarred with the brush of doping quite a bit, which clearly could be a concern for any potential sponsor. What do you do in Team Quebeca Assos to ensure that the team remains true to its values and kind of clean?
Well, I think it comes down to the team culture. I mean, the sport has a great image at the moment and is, you know, is doing really, really well in the space. It's the amount of testing that we do and, you know, the organizations that we are a part of, like the MPCC, the Movement for Professional Credible Cycling, the amount of money and investment we put into, you know, WADA and the internal testing and external testing that happens in the sport. So the sport has done an amazing amount of work to clean up its image, which is absolutely brilliant. I wouldn't want to be running an African team and a team from the continent of Africa, which has such big eyes and such hope, you know, if the sport was still, you know, a sport that where doping was common, because we just wouldn't succeed and you wouldn't be able to achieve the dream goals that, you know, that we've wanted to achieve, you know, in the sport and with riders from the African continent. It would just kill the passion of all of us. But I think from our point of view, you know, we race to mobilize people on bicycles, especially children, to be able to get to school and to do things. So when our riders join our team and, you know, they look at that and they think, you know, this team is not about you. It's about what you can do for others. So the way you engage, the image that you have, the, you know, the things that you do and say and people that you engage with and how is critical to us. And so, you know, this team is not for everybody, but we, you know, we kind of carefully select the individuals that want to be a part of this team and they need to use their success to do something significantly bigger and to give hope to others. So I think that's what drives us. That's what motivates us. It's not about winning at all costs. It's not about any of that other stuff. People don't lose their jobs in this team if they don't win. It has a deeper meaning and a bigger purpose behind it, and that's what motivates us to be successful and to work so hard.
And that's an incredibly strong purpose, and clearly part of the reason why Sport Endorse is so delighted to be working with you. How does that purpose influence the individual riders on a given day? I can think poetically about it, but you know, actually in reality, does it drive them that extra little bit, or how does it impact them?
Well, it connects them together in a way that you might not normally see, and I think that's, you know, it gets them up when the times are tough and they, you know, they don't feel like it, which happens in life and in business and in sport as well. But I mean, they know that their opportunity that day to do something significant, if it helps somebody else, is incredible. So that's not only on the bike, it's also in our staff group. You know, the people that we have on our team, they don't look at this as a job. They look at it as a privilege to enable this team to be better, to go further, so that it can, you know, help somebody else, give you know, them opportunity and hope in life and to succeed in life. And that also connects, you know, through to our partners. And I think our fans feel that too. They feel that engagement, they feel that connection. You know, when the team wins, it's like a victory to them as well, because they support us and they can see the impact that it has in community. So it's a special team in that sense. And I think that's what lifts our every rider, every staff member, you know, when things are not going so well, when we have accidents and the team is down and the plan is not working potentially, then, you know, that's the kind of thing that brings us back together to say, guys, you know, this is not about us. This is about what we can do for others. Let's unite, believe in each other, believe in the, you know, the potential that we have, the opportunity that we're here to do, the privilege that we have to race at the highest level in sport and in this sport of cycling. You know, let's make it count. And I think that's what really, you know, pulls us together in tough times.
I think that, what a comprehensive answer there. Thanks. That's actually probably nixed two or three of my next questions. But one of them was about how you get that team. I mean, if you look at the diverse cultures and the number of different nationalities involved in the team, bringing them all together and getting them to perform and to actually fight for each other so well, and this season so far, it's really impressive. I mean, clearly that purpose is a massive driver there. So, I mean, the main team is the 27 professional riders, but there's also a Conti team as well. So what is a Conti team?
So we have a third division team. So a continental team is a third division team in world cycling. And then there's the pro tour teams, which are the second division, and then the world teams, which are the first division. So we've got a third division team that is a stepping stone. It's an under 23 team, so riders from that are under the age of 23. So that gives them a stepping stone into the world tour. They're based in Lucca in Tuscany, where, you know, where we have our feeder team set up and where our world tour team used to be based. And the world team has now moved to the Netherlands. But the continental team, based in Italy, in Lucca, beautiful place to race and to ride and to train. You know, cycling fanatical environment for them to be able to become accustomed to the Western ways of eating, of living, etc. We have a lot of riders from Africa in that team, from Ethiopia, Eritrea, Rwanda, Morocco. So there's, you know, interesting riders from interesting countries, which really is beautiful. They stay in a team house together. So they kind of live together, train together, race together. It's like a permanent training camp. And 2 years ago, we produced an under 23 world champion out of that team. So it's one of the best development teams in the world. So it's a privilege to have them as a part of us. And we, every year we bring one or two riders from that team and they step up into the world team and kind of graduate up to the first division, which is really special to see and gives us a lot of happiness that we've been able to move people through the ranks because there's a lot of development programs that don't really work. And that's a nice stepping stone, I think, for them. And it's important for us, even though we are a fairly small budget team, it was always important for us to have that development step and that development program in place to give people just that extra bit of hope and that extra bit of support in this big world of first division cycling.
Yeah, no, I love it. I mean, it's a clear pathway, basically, where if they do well enough, they can get up to that first division, and it you know, it helps build that culture quite clearly. So if you take the riders on the first division team and the riders on the Conti team and all the support staff, how big is the actual team?
So 27 riders on the world team, 12 riders on the Conti team. So that's 39. And then, you know, we have around 55 to 65 staff between the two. So you're looking at close to 100 people. That is pretty much the unit and the company, which is pretty cool, actually. It's quite a lot. Some people think, you know, that we only race for 21 days in July during the Tour de France and that's it. But we, you know, we do a lot and we move around a lot and we're about 100 people and we're from 19 different nationalities, and that diversity is absolutely our strength. Getting to know different cultures, different backgrounds, different eating habits, just different people. You know, you never know what the ceiling is. This is not a Dutch team where you kind of grew up together, went to school together, know each other, know your environment, your surroundings, how you behave, how you engage. greetings and all that, you know, just the social skills. You know, I think having a team of ours with this, with its multiple cultures, coming from a country like South Africa with its such diversity, you know, for us it was a pleasure to have this cultural richness that we have in this team, and it's absolutely a strength. And you just see the riders love to talk about their backgrounds and their food and, you know, the way they do things and, you know, their holidays and where they, you know, what their home life is like. So it really brings us together in a beautiful way. So we love the richness of, you know, of our multi-flagged team.
So on the food question there, as a once picky eater, no longer, how does that work? I mean, do the chefs have to try and accommodate different kind of preferences, or is it more or less, look, the nutritionists have said, this is what's good for you, get it into you? Yeah.
So our nutritionists look at people individually. Of course, you know, in a race and in an event where there's, you know, you kind of got to do the 80-20 rule where you kind of accommodate 80% of the group and then the 20% that have certain potential eating habits that you need to customize. But for sure, we focus on individual planning, not a one size fits all. And it's not about just, you know, what you need to have and the calorie intake. It's about delicious and nutritious. So it's a bit of a food science, not a nutritional science, because, you know, dessert and other chocolate and sweets and things like that are also part of food. So we kind of keep it entertaining and interesting and get feedback from the individuals and see what works. So, but yeah, with the ultimate focus around being understanding of every individual and making it delicious and nutritious so that they can get the maximum value and be able to perform at the highest level and be happy with what they're consuming and that their bodies can cope and adapt. So it's a tough environment, that whole energy management space. And there's lots to discuss still, you know, and in the science of that moving forwards and how we, you know, that can be optimized for better performance. But, you know, we have a much more human personal approach than a numbers, calorie and scientific, I guess, you know, data approach.
There you go. Feeds again beautifully into everything you're saying. In my mind, fits into your purpose and the values really, really well. So you mentioned, I think, that the team races across five continents. Back hopefully soon when fans are able to get out on the sides of the road and cheer along. Where on those continents typically would people be able to see you?
Well, I mean, I think Europe is massive at the moment, where the team races predominantly. We do race in Africa occasionally. We do, you know, normally at the beginning or the end of the year in Asia, also towards the end of the year, kind of September, October timeframe into November. There are races in Asia. Australia is normally in the beginning. Tour Down Under is normally the first World Tour race of the season. And then, of course, in the US as well and in Canada, there's races, South America too. So there's, you know, the cycling, what's the beautiful thing about it is it can be done everywhere. And there's different tours like the Africa Tour, Asia Tour, America's Tour, Australasia Tour. So there's amazing amounts of different events and different categories and races that you can ride. But the World Tour, which is the races that we are governed and need to race, are mostly in and around Europe and across Europe. So it's and it culminates, of course, in the three grand tours, the Giro d'Italia, Tour de France, and the Vuelta a España, which are the three big ones. And then the monuments, which are amazing. I mean, it's a sport made up of so many different events for different riders types. And it's which makes it such an engaging and exciting, you know, sport to watch.
Okay, and you've got I know certainly from your social media anyway, you've got a very healthy fan base, and with the jersey design kind of competitions this year in conjunction with ASOS, that's got a lot of traction. So the fan base is from where? Is it geographically dispersed like the riders or like where you cycle, or how does that work?
So we're very strong in Africa. We have probably 20% of our base comes, you know, from the African continent. So that is we're a great story in the African market. And then, you know, a lot in Europe, 30-odd%, I think, are in Europe. And then we have the, you know, 5-10% in those other areas. So the nice thing about a team like ours, which has this passion part of it and this purpose that drives it and underpins it, you know, we kind of the everybody's favorite number two team, you know. So if you have a favorite in like a Peter Sagan in Bora Hansgrohe, or, you know, Chris Froome in Israel Startup Nation or whatever, you know, you when you see our team win, everybody's happy because they know that the success of this team drives further impact and really gives people hope and opportunity. So I think that's the great thing about, I think, being purpose-led and having the team that we have with its diversity and its passion, that it really brings people on and creates a lot of interest and a lot of following in many different countries around the world, because it just has that third layer to it.
Okay. Very good. So we'll shift now a little bit to, in case there are any potential sponsors or partners out there who might want to get involved with the team, I have a couple of questions around that. So I know clearly from talking to you what they can expect, but for anybody listening, what can a sponsor expect when they partner with your team?
Well, they can expect an incredible brand awareness, incredible reach around the world. I think cycling has one of the biggest reaches. And of course, you know, the things that we do, which is really amazing, I think is the content that we generate, the authentic and honest content that we generate, the experiences that you can have in a team like ours, because it's, you know, we don't have a win at all costs team. We bring people into our world, get them to embrace and understand what we do inside the team, behind the scenes. We do a huge amount in that space. So bringing, you know, just your executive, your staff, your employees and your partners and your partner ecosystem, they get an opportunity to engage and experience what the world of cycling really is like. And then of course, engagement, you know, when we have fan engagement, that the competitions that we drive and, you know, that are interesting to a partner around their messaging, their brand, you know, what they're trying to drive sustainably or in gender equality or all of those, you know, areas where sustainability, all those areas where we are incredibly strong, because the world today is all about being mobile, being safe, being healthy. And I think cycling is, you know, fits those values and is right up there when it comes to social distancing and just engaging with people and being able to ride with pros, engage with them virtually, physically, you know, and then, you know, just creating really authentic, honest content. And of course, we're also very strong in the African market. So those are the things that we're very strong in. And I think that's where we make strong connections to our partners.
Okay, that's excellent. And so question around, I mean, clearly there's a lot of sponsors on every cycling team out there. So have there been occasions in your experience where team sponsors wind up doing business with each other?
Absolutely. We don't bring, you know, our partners aren't in silos. You know, we have our whole partnerships for the good, better together strategy that we focus on with our partners, and we encourage them to do business together. A lot of them do come on board because they want to do business with the other. So I think that is pretty amazing. And then of course they all adopt and embrace the purpose of our team, which is the Quebecca charity, to mobilize people on bikes and give them hope and opportunity, either through staff giving or impact days where the organizations come together and do something on a weekend and raise funds for the charity, compete against each other, different divisions, business units, countries. It's kind of fun, gets people out there, you know, in a healthy, energetic way and for a great cause. So we've done some, you know, really, really cool things, and we do that together with, you know, with the organizations, and they get to do business together. They meet new people, they engage, and they get a lot of fun out of it as well, which is great and great visibility.
So now a tough question: do you have an example? So I mean, for the last decade plus, you've been dealing with sponsors. So do you have an example from that where you think a particular sponsor has activated their sponsorship with the team in a way that kind of sets a new standard?
Yeah, we did with Deloitte at the time, we did an impact day where Deloitte around the world signed up for it and rode or ran or swam or walked, you know, like something that challenged them. And then they raised funds for the charity, which was a nice way to bring people in the organization together to understand what we do and to get buy-in. Often sponsorships in organizations, the hardest thing for them, they get the external awareness and the brand awareness, but the hardest thing is to engage internally and to get people internally on sides to understand that this company that's partnering with this sport is doing it, you know, that and it talks to the value system of the company, the why, because for us, it's all about the why. Why do you want to partner with us? What would you like to achieve? How can we leverage and do that together? So I think those are, you know, that was something that was pretty cool. And now even, you know, really recently with ASOS, you know, ASOS stepping in to help keep the team on the road and engaging with our fans to say, you know, what has this team meant to you over the years? What is our jersey and what should it look like? So design a fan jersey for the team, and significant amounts of money of that jersey will then go to mobilize people on bicycles through the Quebecer charity. And, you know, that there was a designer that won. It was a, it's a beautiful jersey, and it, we went over, out to pre-order, you know, just yesterday, and it's had over 2,000, you know, pre-orders in 24 hours, which just shows how unbelievable it is. And that would raise significant money for the charity. So a lot of our partners have really embraced the team, embraced the, you know, the opportunity to do something really good and make it count.
Yeah, no, I love that jersey. I'm actually one of those pre-orders. So, and so around the, I mean, it goes without saying for anybody who has looked at the content you produce, particularly on social media, authentic is a word which I would absolutely ascribe to it. Given the number of different languages spoken among the team, have you the ability to produce content in other languages than English?
So I think our riders have done quite a bit of that. They've put content out in their languages, which is great. But the, you know, English is the language of our team. And so that kind of then filters out into the external domains, which rightly or wrongly, I mean, of course, it would be better to have multiple languages. But I think what we've done is we focused on our riders to, you know, to engage with their fan bases in their languages and bring that through. But yeah, right now, you know, we do communicate in English, and English is the language internally, because we've, with all these multiple cultures, you don't want to have different conversations and riders grouping in their nationalities, you know, at the dinner table, the staff and the riders. You're trying to encourage connectivity and, you know, them to understand each other. So, you know, we communicate obviously in English, and then on the race radio and the team radios, when we're talking to riders, we communicate in English so that it's just, you know, everybody understands what's going on, and there's nobody that feels that someone might be talking behind their back, but that's internal. But so pretty much all our content is driven, you know, by English.
From the team language. Okay, that makes perfect sense. So very quickly, we'll just hit on some hard numbers around the business of the cycling team. So how much does it cost to keep the team on the road each season? Let's say bare bones, because there's a follow-up question, which is, you know, how to kind of supercharge it. So bare bones, what does it cost to keep it on the road?
If you think that the major cost goes into the salaries of the riders, so 65 to 67% of a team's budget goes to salaries. So the minimum budget of a team is 8 to 9 million euro would be kind of the bare bones budget to put a team together. And then of course it goes up to the, I think the number one team in the world at the moment is, or biggest budget team, is around 50 million. So that's the kind of scope and range. But it, you know, like I said, 65 to 67% of our budget goes to salaries. So it's
goes to the salaries on that. Okay.
Then the rest is logistics and operational costs and staff costs. So that's pretty much where that goes.
That goes. Okay. So, and let's say there's somebody listening, and hopefully there is, who really loves the story and says, you know what, I really want to get behind Doug and the team, and I want to bring them or help them get to the point whereby it's not win at all costs. Let's maintain the culture. Love that. But let's give them the ability where they can challenge for, as a team, winning a grand tour. What does that look like?
Yeah, you'd need to be on a starting budget of around 20 million. So you're looking at 20 to 25 million would be a budget that you could then build a project, build a plan, and then target it, you know, winning a grand tour. So that's kind of the, and that doesn't have to come from one partner. That can come from multiple partners, of course, but that's kind of the numbers that you would be looking at.
So 20 to 25 million. And presumably, like most things, it's not like you turn on the switch and it happens. It would take a number of years to build up to that point, I'm guessing. Am I right?
It can, or? if you have a plan with younger riders. I mean, we've always dreamt of bringing African riders through the program, having a sustainable project that you can build for 3 to 5 years, where you can bring some riders through and then, you know, see the fruits of your investment. Of course, in sporting terms, you can always buy and transfer a really very successful rider into your team and do things quicker. That's possible. But it's, you know, there's also an opportunity to then have a stepped approach, the phased approach, and then actually, you know, over a 3 to 5 years, build a, you know, a plan to do something, you know, that had never been done in the sport before, and make history, and open, you know, the eyes of the world to a continent of cyclists that they might never have seen before. So that's something that we've, you know, planned and have been dreaming of piecing together.
It's interesting. In my head there at one moment, linking back to my, I guess, my finance background for 10 years, I was thinking, wow, what an investment. I mean, if you look at the success of African runners in middle to long distance, if I was a betting man, I'd be investing in African cyclists to be able to do phenomenally well as well.
Well, that's why, you know, we do that anyway with, you know, everybody says to me, you know, what are you doing for the development of cycling on the African continent? So I said, well, first we've got to get bicycles to the African continent so that we can get people moving and people mobile in a sport or, you know, on bicycles, so that we have a bigger footprint to choose from. And then when we hand and or distribute the bicycles in these communities with our pro riders, and they tell them that they earn a living off this bicycle, it opens their eyes up to a sport that they, for the most part, didn't really know existed, because they look at this tool as a thing to get you from A to B, here to school, to the clinic, to your neighbor, to your granny, to your community, to whatever, you know. But they don't realize and think that, oh my gosh, you know, I could actually earn a living off this, and this could be a sport, my sport. And then they start racing each other. They start, you know, racing around the school fields, and it just changes the dynamic a little bit. So that's the, you know, so we do a lot in terms of the distribution and what of bicycles through Quebeca, and how we, you know, race around the world to try and raise funds to put more people on bicycles so that we can, you know, grow that pipeline of potential talent.
Okay, so I've got my last kind of serious questions, and then we can relax a bit. Like COVID-19, which and the pandemic you've mentioned before, basically it's given the world a good kicking. Cycling, most sports haven't escaped. How have you been adapting with sponsors to ensure the sponsor is satisfied, and also that you can continue to shine a light on the Quebeca movement?
We did a lot with our partners, particularly with last year, when we were all struggling. You know, everybody had never been so disconnected, and we actually as a team and with our partners had never actually felt more connected. We created, you know, just podcasts and virtual meetings just to talk about our circumstances and what, you know, what hope we could provide and give people some, you know, ultimate motivation. And I think the three things that we focused on, you know, during the pandemic internally, and then of course externally in our partner network, and then ultimately to, you know, to our fan base, when we created that Be Moved video, where, you know, as I said, is a time when you couldn't move, you know, how we were moving people. And for us, the three things were people, purpose, and opportunity. So, you know, what was it like with our people, our partners? You know, what could we do to try and help them understand the situation, give them hope, get them up every single day? You know, how do we mobilize people? How do we get them energetic, energized, you know, through our purpose? And how do we continue to try and connect with them virtually, eyeball them and understand their situations? And then, of course, use it as an opportunity to be better, to improve on our weaknesses. And you know, the virtual Tour de France was a case in point where we embraced that so much and then eventually, you know, won it because we took it really, really seriously and got our riders engaged with the right equipment to be able to still stay connected and be together. So, you know, those are the kind of things that we really focused on during that time. And we did amazing things. We did a partner challenge. We created groups of 50 individuals with a pro rider through our whole partner network across all of our partners. And over a weekend, we rode the same length of distance as the Tour de France with people swimming, running, riding. It was quite cool. So we really did, you know, kind of bring people together, even though we were so disconnected.
That's wonderful. And my last question, it's kind of a trends and sponsorship type question. And if possible, we kind of forget COVID for a second. So over the decade plus you've been running the team and dealing with sponsors, have you noticed a shift or a change in what sponsors look for in order to kind of satisfy whatever KPIs they have internally themselves? Or has it remained sort of similar?
I think it has definitely changed. You know, partners are no longer, and sponsors are no longer looking just for brand awareness. They're looking for engagement. They're looking for incredible experiences. They want to generate content and talk about things and make an impact in the world as that we live in today, where humanity is suffering. I mean, and I think the world is also, you know, struggling, and people are. So irrespective of COVID, and, you know, I think COVID just made us realize that we need to catch a wake up, be more patient and just breathe and think without just being in this run mode all the time. But I think the world was heading there anyway. People are really caring about, you know, the environment more and our impact on that, and how we can use sponsorships, the messaging, connect with people in incredible ways, because sport still connects with people in ways that nothing else does. It's exciting. It's just the endorphins, the everything, it drives us. And I think that's kind of, you know, really interesting and something that we've been doing a long time. You know, we've been purpose led for 10 years now. You know, last year we celebrated at the Tour de France our 10 years of working together with Quebeca, which was really, really cool. So it was something that we saw right in the beginning, that we wanted to use our success to do good. And I think that's what many, many organizations are looking at now. They want to use their brands, their people, to ultimately do good things and make the world a better place for all.
Yeah, no, I've noticed that myself. It's nice to have it confirmed. And if I'm not mistaken, you the Tour de France chose Quebec as their chosen charity for last year. Is that correct?
That's correct. They've done it for the last 3 years, where they chose Quebec as one of their official charities. You know, Africa is very French. It was very French colonized. And so, you know, there was a big interest in Africa anyway. And of course, us as a team, a new team on the block with such a strong purpose that they care about, of the, you know, the mobility of people and giving a helping hand up to, you know, to people. They loved what we stood for embraced Quebec as a charity for them.
Ah, that's brilliant. So last penultimate one is just a couple of quick fire questions around the team itself. So the riders, and we'll focus, you can extend this out to the 12 Conti team riders as well, if you want. So you have 39 people to pick on. If I was to say, give me the name of the team joker, who would that be?
Yeah, Victor Campenaerts has created this YouTube channel, our Belgian guy. So he's all over the place. But yeah, I would say Victor Campenaerts is our team joker.
Okay. And what about a team DJ, or someone who thinks they have the coolest music?
Yeah, Michael Gergel, our Austrian, he was playing such dodgy music in the bus over the classics. I have no idea like what he... I don't know where he comes from, but it was just bizarre. So Michael Gergel will definitely take the DJ.
What about the best linguist? So the person who speaks the most languages. That's probably a tough one to answer.
Yeah, we had a rider last year in our team that spoke many languages. I actually don't really know who's fluent in a lot of languages in our team at this point in time. Maybe Simon Clark. I think he's Australian. I mean, that's already a funny language, but he speaks, you know, really good Italian. And you know, I was listening, and he lives in Italy, has an Italian wife, but I'm not so sure what other languages he speaks. But he's Australian. So there's already three: English, Australian, Italian.
Pretty good stuff. Person with the biggest appetite.
Yeah, that's Max Walschat. I mean, he's probably the biggest unit in cycling. He's 90 odd kilos, 1.92 meters tall. Our only German rider on the team. He has a presence when he walks in the door. But I'm just going because he's our biggest.
Okay, fair enough. All right, and then three kind of questions about you or for you. If you had to pick one sporting hero so far, who?
I actually don't really have any sporting heroes. I have like other, you know, people that I look up to, like Nelson Mandela, you know, people that have gone through amazing change, who obviously loved sport. But you know, I don't really have an iconic sporting hero per se.
That's perfectly okay. Nelson Mandela is a fine choice as a hero. Your favorite way to relax? I have my own theory on this, in that you never get to relax, but that's a different one.
Yeah.
If you could, what would your favorite way to relax be?
Well, I really struggle to sit down and not do anything and be busy. But you know, I love reading fictional legal courtroom novels. So that's what that takes my mind off off my current crazy life.
Okay. And if not cycling, what would your favorite sport be?
I have taken to running quite hectically recently, just because I'm, you know, with time and not having a lot of time. So I've actually quite enjoyed running. I never thought I would, because you don't get to experience so many places or you don't go very far. Well, it's particularly not me, but you know, we are cycling you in the same amount or in the amount of time you can go really far. But I've actually really started to enjoy running, so I would do running.
Okay, and last question for you: the best thing that's happened to you so far this week?
More than 2,300 people that have pre-ordered on our beautiful Fan Quebecer kit. That actually gives me the reason why I fought so hard to keep this team on the road last year to this year, and gives me a lot of good feeling. So yeah, thanks to all of those that ordered that beautiful jersey.
Great, Doug. Thank you very much. I've put a lot of questions your way and you've answered them with the honesty and passion that I knew you would. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I hope that everybody listening has now got a good understanding of what Team Quebec stands for, its purpose, and why Sport Endorse is proud to be helping you. Thanks very much again, and the very best of luck for the rest of the season.
Yeah, Angie, thanks so much.
That's all for this episode. Thanks once again to Doug and to everyone continuing to download and listen to The Sit Down. We truly appreciate your support. If you are interested in partnering with Team Quebec and helping Doug and the team to make a significant difference to the lives of many, send us an email at quebeca@sportendorse.com. That's quebeca@sportendorse.com, or reach out to us via social media. There's also a rider advocacy program worth considering, and the team's riders are available on the Sport Endorse platform, which is at platform.sportendorse.com. Be sure to follow Sport Endorse on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn for all the latest updates. Until next time, take care and stay safe.